I wanted to take just a moment to talk to you about one of my favorite conferences, Angle Brackets. It's in Las Vegas this year, November 10th through the 13th. We've got some amazing speakers. We've got Scott Guthrie, Michelle Bustamante, Kathleen Dollard, Douglas Crockford is joining us again this fall, Julie Lerman, Elijah Manner, and many, many more. It's also a nice conference because it is co-located with Dev Intersections, which means that if you register for Angle Brackets at anglebrackets.org, you can go back and forth seamlessly to sessions within Dev Intersections, so you get to go to both conferences. If you register by October 20th, you get the early bird bonus, and if you get the show package, you'll get your choice of a Surface, a Dell Venue Pro 8, or an Xbox One. Lots of great reasons to check out Angle Brackets. We'll have lots of keynotes, we'll have meetups and open spaces, lots and lots of sessions. You might even want to check out a pre-conference or post-conference workshop. Bring the family, hang out by the pool at the MGM Grand. We're going to have a lot of fun. We're going to talk about the open web. There'll be conference sessions on AngularJS, on Breeze, on jQuery, on the next version of ASP.NET. Lots of open source, lots of fun stuff. It's at anglebrackets.org, November 10th through the 13th. Now is the time. Tell your boss you want to go to Angle Brackets.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 445. In this episode, Scott talks with Val Head about CSS animations.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm here at the Blend Conference in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I'm talking with Val Head. How are you?
Good. How are you doing, Scott?
Fantastic. Fantastic. Having lots of fun here at the conference.
Yeah, it's been a great first like day and a bit. It's been fun.
Mm-hmm. So you're a user experience expert. You're a designer. You do CSS. You do all these kind of things. What are you talking about at Blend?
Well, I'm talking tomorrow near the end of the day, and I'm talking about UI animation for the web. So animating our interfaces that we design and develop for websites and how we can do that using web standards, which is kind of basically my favorite thing ever.
It seems like there was a time when anytime we can animate something, we will try to do it. So it seems like Flash was like invented just so we could fly things around the page.
Yeah.
And as soon as we learned that we could, we abused it.
Yes. Yeah, Flash sort of has a bad rap for that, right? You know, all the Flash intros and everything. But, most of those were completely terrible and awful. But I think on one side of it, we were trying to do something there when we made those intros. You know, we were looking for a creative way to, convey our message, convey what the site was about, what that company was about to people visiting. Perhaps not the best choice in hindsight, maybe a terrible choice. But, you know, I think we learned a lot from that, both in the fact that like motion is an expressive way to convey design and, you know, what you're all about. Intros, maybe not really the way to do it. Though they're kind of coming back now.
Really? The big like JavaScript loading intro.
Not quite as bad. We've definitely learned some lessons. There's not the big loading, like count up to 100 that takes 5 years. But a lot of these, a lot of like iOS apps or, you know, just general mobile apps who are, their sites basically are just to promote their app, right? Mm. So they'll have a lot of sites that really what they're trying to do is tell the story of why their product exists. And what they're creating are essentially like intros, but better because they have a lot of motion. They're kind of telling this more or less linear story of like, here is my app. Here's why you might want it. Go download it. And I think that's really interesting. It's like intros 2.0, but like actually useful.
It seems like a lot of the first time you've ever been here or first time you've run type intros are those kind of intros. Like, this is an iOS app. Look how friendly I am.
Yeah.
Here's an arrow. Welcome. You want to push here. You want to do that. In case you weren't familiar with the hamburger icon. That's what this is.
Yeah, there's a lot of those too. I mean, that's a whole other use for it as well, is these kind of instructional type things. And I know I did a lot of Flash back in the day, and that was probably, I did a ton of those of like, how to use this software? And we're kind of still doing it. You know, I'm sure some people would say if you need to do that, there's a problem with your UX. I don't know if that's really a hard, fast, black and white rule, but you know, there's still tons of use for these things like intros and these, you know, kind of walkthroughs that we ripped on Flash for. But it's like, you know what? They weren't all bad. We just need to pick the good stuff.
I remember reading somewhere that motion and quick cuts in children's cartoons, like the idea of like camera one, camera two, camera two, camera one, was that the when things happen in the periphery of our vision, it fires a certain part of our brain that basically says, there could be a predator.
No, I think that's true. I mean, I don't know if, I can't think of the exact studies, but I know I've read stuff like that too. And it's kind of also why, you know, it's why those stupid banner ads for like mortgages have like the dancing dude, or why car dealerships have
you
that weird tube guy.
Look at them.
Exactly.
You have to look at them.
So it's like motion is so powerful, and we've mostly used it for evil on the web. If you mean banner ad evil, I don't know if that counts as
true evil. No, that's evil.
Yeah, they're generally pretty evil. So I kind of like to convince people, or, you know, just tell people in my talks about how we can use that, harness that power for good, and we can make things that are really useful and helpful. And it doesn't just have to be banner ads and intros. And it just really shouldn't be those, actually.
There was a time when post-Flash, pre kind of HTML5 or pre-modern web, when jQuery was how people did this. They would make these tight loops, and they would animate CSS properties. And then I'm hearing more and more that that can cause battery drain and power issues. Then we now have CSS animations. Is that the kind of animations people should primarily be looking at?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a bit of a confusing time, because like you said, we had Flash, and that was your only option for adding animation. And then that went away, and like jQuery was our only option for animation. And now it's like, you could use JavaScript, you could use CSS, you could use SVG. It's like, there's so many things. And then you can also animate SVG with CSS or with JavaScript. And then there's the whole like Canvas WebGL situation. So it's kind of extremely overwhelming.
It's extremely overwhelming. And I'd like to understand, like, for what class of animation do I use what technology? And if I pick one of these technologies, what if I pick the wrong one?
Yeah, I think the good news is it's pretty hard to pick the wrong one entirely. And also, it's really hard. There's not like one that's always better. I mean, a lot of the marketing stuff, especially for some of these kind of third-party engines and libraries, are all like, ours is the best. It's faster than CSS. And you're like, but I mean, that kind of doesn't matter. You know, we're always using things like JavaScript and CSS and HTML together on the web, because that's how the web is built. And, you know, one being better than the other isn't really ever true, because no matter what, you know, if you make really poor decisions with whatever tool you're using, you can make it bad. Or if you make really good decisions, whatever tool you're using, you can make it good. So I don't know. I like to think it's more about the person making it than the tool.
I try not to make my decisions based on like micro benchmarks. Like I can do this a million times in a loop way better than library B.
Yeah, but you're like, how many times are you going to be doing a million things in a loop? But part of the reason why jQuery specifically has kind of fallen out of favor for that is basically now browsers have gotten a lot faster, like JavaScript in general, and this whole request animation frame thing, which jQuery Animate doesn't use. So it's kind of like, that's part of the reason why the battery drain and everything happens. It's like,
so what is that request animation frame?
It's a little complicated, but basically it's the browser kind of keeping track of a frame rate of when things are updating, and based on, you know, various factors of essentially how fast it can update things and repaint what needs to be repainted or redraw. Paint might be the wrong word there, but whatever. And so if you have something like jQuery Animate that's just like trying to do stuff a million times a second, but maybe the request animation frame can't keep up to that rate, you may be changing things multiple times, like 50 times, and only be able to see an update once. And then you're doing all this extra work and nobody can see it.
So let me see if I can understand that. So when I play video games, some people say you need to run at 100 frames a second. But, you know, it's going to cause visual tearing. It's not going to look right. And it also is unnecessary work. So I usually press it's called V-Align Sync. And it says, go at the same speed that my monitor can go.
Yeah.
My monitor can do 60 frames a second. Don't bother. So you're saying that if I write an animation in a kind of a thoughtless way, I could be trying to animate something 1,000 times a second.
Yeah.
But request animation frame is going to take 15 or 20 or 30 or whatever my computer is capable of.
Yeah, it's really similar to that monitor thing. It's like you can ask the browser to change things way faster than it might be able to. So, you know, when you're doing things like actually you can, you know, access the request animation frame information through JavaScript. Apparently a lot of CSS animations, like internally in the browsers are actually using that same request animation frame, I guess, engine you might call it. You can't reference it in any way through CSS, but many browsers take the CSS animations, and while they are, you know, interpreting or basically displaying your animation, they're using that same internal mechanism. So that's part of the reason why CSS animations can also be so, you know, really efficient when it comes to battery usage, all that kind of stuff.
Let the browser do what the browser's good at. Don't overthink it.
Yeah, but it's and I like to say that the best thing about CSS animations is it's all handled in the browser, but the worst thing about CSS animations is that it's all handled in the browser because, you know, you're handing that off. You don't have that control. The browser's taking care of it. Sometimes it doesn't do what you want to do, and it's still completely possible to create CSS animations that will kill your battery. Like, there's no complete fail-safe way. If you try hard enough, you can totally break anything.
I sometimes feel like programmers who came from the back end, like myself, think procedurally. I can write ifs and fors and everything is from top to bottom, while designers are more kind of big picture and declarative. CSS is declarative and HTML is declarative. So there's this mountain that we're trying to drill a hole through. I'm on one side doing it the procedural way. Designers are trying to do it the declarative way. CSS animations seem like a little of both. Like, when I write an animation, though, I want to write it in code. CSS is very declarative, but CSS animations can let you do keyframes and things.
It's still very declarative, though. I mean, when you're dealing with CSS animations and keyframes specifically, I mean, you write out those keyframes and that keyframe list is there, and you can be like, hey, assign this list of keyframes I made. And keyframes is just like a list of what you want to have happen.
It's over a moment in time, right? Like, at this point, it should look like that.
Like, you may have a list of three things you want to have happen. You're like, the animation should do these three things in this order, and those are my keyframes. And you can take those keyframes and apply them to, you know, any element on your page that's animatable, which is just about anything these days. But you can't change those keyframes. So they are declarative still. It's like, you're like, here's what's going to happen. And you can assign it to whatever you want. But that list you created is never going to change. Yeah. And, you know, that's good and that's bad. Sometimes that, you know, sometimes that's perfect. You're like, awesome. And that's part of, you know, you can make this list of what you want to have happen. You're like, that's always what I want to have happen. But if you're in a situation, you're like, well, sometimes I want to do this and sometimes I want to do that. Like, then CSS isn't maybe so well equipped. You know, that's where the less declarative and more, I'm not sure what the opposite of declarative
procedural
is. Yeah, or more flexible, more program type animation.
So that means, like, if I'm going to do really a data-driven animation, I might use SVG and D3JS, something like that.
Yeah, and the kind of idea, you know, with things like JavaScript, you can create these, I guess you might even call them more like physics-based animations, where you're like, here's your gravity and your drag, and, you know, it kind of adapts more that way, where CSS, you're just like, here is your motion. And both, you know, both are usable when it comes to animating UIs or creating any animation. It's just two different approaches. And there's a big, huge gray area where either one could go. And then there's kind of outliers where you should probably stick to one or the other.
Is this something I'm going to want to use a tool for? Like something that's like almost a mini movie editor that's going to then generate some crazy CSS? Or do I write this in a text editor?
Unfortunately, there isn't a good visual editor yet, and that actually really annoys me. Because I don't think it should be, especially for, you know, something where you're writing declarative keyframes and making this list ahead of time. Why should it be a requirement that you have to do that in code? Like, why can't someone who thinks more visually, you know, visually have a timeline in front of them?
You know, the only editor I've seen that's even close to that isn't technically a CSS editor. It's Google's editor that you use to make banner ads.
Oh, yeah. What do they call that? Web designers? It's some strange name.
Well, it's given a name that makes you feel like it cares about you.
Yeah.
Like Google Web Designer. I'm a web designer. And then you download it and it's like, make banner ad.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, oh, this is a thing to make flashy Geico ads.
And you're like, that's not what I wanted. Exactly. There's a couple almost tools. There's that. Adobe has Edge Animate, which is also timeline based.
Right.
Interestingly, it just spits out a bunch of jQuery animation. So it's still browser based, but it doesn't give you CSS animation right now. It may in the future. I kind of hope it does.
That would be great.
Apparently Mozilla is working on an in-browser CSS animation editor of some kind.
Isn't that the way, though? It's all going to be in-browser. Even things like some of the Edge tools are just, you know, the browser in a frame.
Yeah. And I guess Mozilla has some kind of web audio editing tool already. So I'm interested to see what their animation one looks like, because that's a huge gap in the tools we have to create CSS based animation right now. Is like, you gotta code it, and I think that's kind of unfair. Like, why should you have to?
So the kinds of things that I might want to do are really, move things around, mm-hmm. make things pulse or glow, but then also more sophisticated, like maybe even a character or a basic character animation. How complicated can it get?
It can get pretty complicated. I feel like the CSS animations are, the biggest limit is your patience to write keyframes.
Really?
Because you can essentially, you can go from 0 to 100% and you can have decimals. So mm-hmm. you effectively can have nearly, basically infinite number of keyframes. There probably is a limit, but I'm sure you'd get tired of writing them before you hit that. So it can get pretty complex, and you can do a lot of complex transforms with CSS transforms. So it's actually pretty impressive. It's really more your patience to write it out, since you do have to do it by hand, mm-hmm. and it is declarative. So if you want to edit things, that can be kind of messy too. So mm-hmm. that's kind of the big thing that's missing, is like a really handy editor for changing this stuff without driving yourself crazy.
So let me see, even though we're on a podcast mm-hmm. and people can't hear us, they can go to your website and they can look at your screencast. Mm-hmm. You've got screencasts on how to do this. Of course, it is funny to be doing animation, but let's try kind of two thought experiments.
Sure.
So if I have a button mm-hmm. on my page and someone shows up on the page, and let's say that they're sitting around for 10 seconds and they haven't moved yet. Mm-hmm. And they're like, they haven't made their decision. So I'm detecting the user's not made their decision. And I want to make the button kind of pulse, mm-hmm. like get larger and get smaller. How would I even start doing that in CSS animation?
Well, you probably want to, first I should mention my screencast is called All the Right Moves, and it is listed on my site. It's a dorky Tom Cruise movie reference. It's mm-hmm. really funny.
Have you
heard of it?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Most people haven't. Anyways.
I will put that in the show notes, as well as a link to the Tom Cruise scenes.
Awesome. Yeah. But to do that, you would definitely need two things, because you want to detect that your user has been inactive. So mm-hmm. you probably do that with JavaScript somehow, tracking your mouse movement or lack thereof, some kind of timer or mm-hmm. whatever. And then you could do the animation itself by writing some keyframes in CSS to do, transform, like scale up and down, however you want to do that. Maybe a little bit of, translation as well. However crazy you want the
Because I guess I could have it wiggle mm-hmm. or get bigger. So like XY scale.
Yeah, and you even have that depth. Like you can do 3D transforms really easily in CSS. It's actually the easiest 3D ever. It's like rotate something on the X axis.
Seriously.
Done.
So then the keyframe, like would one keyframe be it in its normal mm-hmm. state?
Yeah, I like to start, there's kind of a debate about that as to whether you should actually have a first keyframe at its initial state. Mm-hmm. I think you should, because it makes, for me and the way I think about stuff, it makes things a lot easier. Some people are like, oh my God, you wrote an extra line of code, the world is going to end. If you're on that side,
well, I want to return to that state. I want to reference that state. Yeah. It makes sense to have it be a state.
I like having it there. So you can have your first keyframe could be your existing state, mm-hmm. And then you might have, maybe like 30% or something. You make it bigger, scale it up to 150 or maybe probably like 120 or something. 150 is a pretty mm-hmm. big increase, and then maybe like 60%, you go down to like 110, so it's not just a straight linear back and forth. With keyframes, you can kind of have these little stages in and out, like make it a pulse a little bit bigger, a little smaller, and then, have it go back at the end to its original state. That's how I would do it. I like mm-hmm. having the beginning and end state there in my keyframes, because I'm terrible at remembering what I wrote like 10 lines up.
So, sideways mm-hmm. sidebar, you brought up something that I think that you would find intuitive, but I don't think everyone who's listening would, mm-hmm. which is as a non-designer person, my first reaction would be like, make it bigger, mm-hmm. make it smaller. And it would end up looking like this, like 1980s Wolfenstein, where it just goes, ooh.
Yeah.
But there's like easing in mm-hmm. and easing out. Can you maybe talk about that a little bit and how that affects why it looks right to us more than?
Yeah. Well, there's lots of, easing is basically kind of like the key to making animations look good. For better or for worse, the default easing in CSS is ease, which actually starts out slow, is fastest in the middle, and ends slow. And that's kind of like if you've ever heard of the Disney principles of animation, the illusion of life, one of their main principles is like, slow in and slow out. Basically, the idea of in real life, nothing starts moving at full speed and then stops at full speed. Everyone needs to like speed up, hit their full speed, and then when they're going to stop, they generally slow down. Mm-hmm. So by using that kind of, ease in, ease out situation where you start slow, fastest in the middle, that feels much more natural. And of course, there's like 500 different ways to do ease in, ease out, because we have the keywords of like ease, the keyword of ease in, ease out. And then CSS also has cubic Bezier curves where you can essentially define nearly any type of motion curve you want, as long as it only has two control points, but there's still a lot of options. So you can adjust how fast you speed up, how quickly you reach your top speed, and how quickly you drop off to slow down. So, and that's kind of like the whole personality of the animation.
And is are those curves just described as like a series of numbers, like this kind of this?
Yeah, it's four numbers. The easiest way to look at them is as motion graphs, and there's a site called cubicbezier.com that gives you the numbers and the graph that you can play with. There's also Caesar, which is a fun tool. I like it that it's a pun because it's like CSS easing Caesar. Oh, it's great. So there's a few tools out there to give you that visual connection, because essentially the four numbers reference the position of the two control points of your curve, but normal humans don't generally think like that. I like to see the curve.
Well, I don't know about you, but...
You do. You think in series of numbers. No, I have no idea. And basically, wherever the graph or the curve is steepest, you're going faster, and wherever it's flattest, you're going slower, and you have, you know,
I see,
a lot of combinations.
So I'm trying to visualize that. Like, I might want to really start slow, really, really keep, you know, kind of ease up, but then I want to end really quickly. So that's like a gradual start, a plateau, and then a drop off. I can describe that curve in a Bezier curve.
Yeah, it would actually just be kind of like a ramp up and then straight across the top, because flat is like, it's still going in time, but the speed has been slowed down. So yeah, there's so many options you can create for yourself there.
So the button's one example, but that's a basic example of one element. Let's say I want to make a little person. He's got a head, he's got a torso, and he's got two legs. So it's circle, rectangle, rectangle. Do I name those elements and group them in some way? Do I make them SVG? Do I like have like the head div and the torso div? And then, but now I'm starting to get like, is CSS and HTML meant to be used in this way? Because you see people making like Mario entirely in CSS. It's like, well, should you be doing that? How would I make that little man walk?
Well, kind of how you describe, like you'd want to have him in pieces, essentially. Very similar to how you would if you were going to animate him in After Effects or something as well. You know, you'd need to have separate limbs, or you're not going to be able to make them move. And I actually have a little example I use in my workshop that I call Bob the Robot, where we do essentially that. it's a fun way to play around with keyframes. You know, you're making a robot move. Who wouldn't want to do that? And so we have his head, his robot body, his arms, and his legs are all separate things. We position them all with CSS. And then create separate animations for essentially each of his limbs, and his head. He can bob and do whatever
he wants. He and the code don't know he's attached. Like, it looks like he's walking only because the keyframes that move his leg are ending up in the same location that his torso. But ultimately, they're not attached. They don't know that no vertices are attached to each other.
No, there's nothing like that. I mean, usually it's probably going to save you a lot of time if you stick him in like a containing div in some way, so you can move the entire robot as well. Your HTML document doesn't know his leg from a paragraph, essentially. I guess that's kind of weird, but you know, everything is just an object and you're just manipulating it with these styles and, you know, essentially marking it up and then styling it with CSS. Just, you're actually having this time dimension and motion as well.
In your talk that you give on this, and you do talks, and there's also workshops, and of course your screencasts, what are some do's and do nots? What are some like, you can do this, never do this? In CSS animation, what are some do's and do nots?
My do's and don'ts are usually more about making like useful animation and animation that's like good quality and the stuff people would want to see and that you'd want to make. Because I feel like, just like type and color and all these things, animation is an aspect of design we can use to differentiate our products and convey our message. And if we use it well, people, you know, it's like, that's what makes something that might have been okay to be like amazing is when you make these good decisions. So, I like to talk about the do's and don'ts of just things like, you know, to always make sure you're responding to the user in a way that feels right. You know, like create lots of prototypes and see what's happening. Like for your button example, you know, create that really fast in something like CodePen or JSPen, whatever, and try it out. Like when you are, you know, click on it, or when you're not active for a while, does it feel like it's responding to you when you click on it? Does it feel like it's actually, you know, doing what you want or being aware of your interaction? And then secondly, is it doing it in a way that conveys the message you sort of want? You know, we were talking about the slow and out. If it's going really, really fast and you are like, I don't know, like a site about meditation and yoga, maybe that doesn't fit so well.
Right. Does it convey information?
Yeah.
Is it stressing the person out?
Exactly.
But it seems like restraint then mm-hmm. is a really important aspect to animation.
And that's that it is. I mean, it's kind of like really good design is like the design that's most amazing. You kind of don't notice. I think animation is sort of similar, but it's very hard not to notice because you were talking about how we just notice these things in the fright and flight sort of aspect. But, you know, and that's where prototyping really comes in handy as well. It's like you want to find these interactions and these times and whatever this interface you're creating is where, you know, maybe you do need some extra information, you know, to call attention to something, to kind of give the spatial awareness of where things are. You know, we use a lot of, you know, kind of hiding layers of sites and apps behind other things. Mm-hmm. Motion's a great way to indicate where that stuff came from and went to. You know, look for those places where some additional information would be helpful, and then basically prototype the crap out of it to make sure what you're building feels right mm-hmm. and is conveying information. And that's kind of the key to it. I mean, it's like wrapping up a very complex thing into a simple rule, but you know, do that as much as possible and practice it, and you'll get better at it, and you'll start making awesome animations, basically.
At the beginning of our conversation, mm-hmm. you said that some people think that like if you have to point to something or make it wiggle, then mm-hmm. maybe you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
I saw a gentleman give a presentation, and he was talking about the hamburger, which mm-hmm. is the three horizontal lines that all developers, designers, and programmer types understand.
Yeah.
But none of our non-technical relatives have any idea what it means. And he was talking about some testing where you put this hamburger grippy thing mm-hmm. and, you know, X percentage of people click it, and then you just change the word to menu mm-hmm. and then everyone starts to click it. But it seems like we really don't want to just have the word menu. We want to have something visually interesting. So people will make arrows that will point at the thing, like your first run.
Yeah.
Kind of like, look at that. Look at that. You really want to click that. Or, you know, iOS apps will dim out the screen
yeah.
and force you to click on it. So they've proven you've done it at least once. So some developers and designers think that that's a crutch. Would you say that those are examples where animation, you know, easing between two transitions is a way of leading the person kind of down the primrose path?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, if you have an interaction that's a little different, and I've also seen that in a lot of iOS apps that kind of have almost this little intro to it that show you with like little dots of like where to swipe and, you know, how to swipe, even though that's
a little picture
common,
of a hand kind
yeah.
of doing.
Even though that's a really common mobile, like, you know, handheld screen interaction. So I think some help is good. I mean, the hamburger icon one is an interesting argument because it's kind of like, on one hand, you're like, well, did anyone know what the save icon meant when we first had it?
Well, yeah, because
people have learned.
But it was, no, I would disagree. It was a picture of a disc.
Oh, true. It was a picture of a disc. But there's definitely like, we can learn what these abstract things mean over time. And maybe the hamburger icon isn't going to last over time. I don't know. But it's like, it's pretty new. We've been doing it maybe
it's only
a few
been a
years.
Couple years, yeah.
So, I mean,
well, like I showed my wife how in the Facebook app mm-hmm. you can swipe in the middle of the Facebook app
yeah.
to the side, and it opens this like drawer.
Mm-hmm.
She freaked out
because she didn't know it was there.
She had no idea it was there, and I'm like, yeah. for every one of me, there's a million,
yeah.
like 100 people who have never seen that before.
I
like
think
when
we're
you
there.
Show people like double tapping on
yeah.
an iPhone, like what?
But I think where if it's tricky is like stuff like that, that's like extra information. It's fine if you don't see it. But mm-hmm. things like your main menu, I think that's why the hamburger icon is so hotly debated in a way, because it's a strange icon we've introduced that doesn't make sense to a lot of people. And it's how we get to our main navigation, which is generally a place people are trying to go. And, you know, really adding the word menu next to it, I mean, that seems mm-hmm. like a pretty good compromise. Sometimes I wonder why we debate it so much.
One animation I saw that was really cool to introduce this idea of mm-hmm. here's a hamburger menu and there's something behind it wasn't wiggling the menu and it wasn't pointing an arrow mm-hmm. to it. It was just when you were at an idle state, it was just gently pulling out, mm-hmm. peeking behind.
Like giving you a little hint.
Just kind of going,
yeah.
hey, look over here. And then the person's like, what was that? Right? And then they want to kind of pull it
yeah.
in. That feels like a good animation to me. It's
yeah,
a little
definitely.
More subtle.
Yeah, so there's definitely things where, you know, that's probably way more effective than having a weird flashing arrow of just like, here's sort of how it works and just a little hint at where things are and where things come from. Like that, and I feel like that's the kind of stuff you get by trying things out. Like maybe whoever came up with that tried an arrow and was like, this is obnoxious. Like tried flashing stuff and were like, oh, this is still obnoxious. Oh, what if I do this?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how you discover these really great interactions.
And when you find a really good interaction mm-hmm. or a really good animation, I know you've probably had the experience where it's like, oh, they thought about that.
Yeah,
you know what
exactly.
I mean? Like I remember the first time that I had a list with a little grippy and I grabbed an item to rearrange it in mm-hmm. the list and the other list items like run out of the way. Like,
yeah.
They're like getting out of my way. I'm like, someone, it just feels crafted. It's, I think a really good animation is that moment where mm-hmm. it's like, they could have just went like snap, snap,
yeah.
snap. Like, remember when you would have a sorting and manual list, there'd be an arrow up and an arrow down.
Yeah, and they're just kind of jumping, and you weren't even sure which one moved.
Yeah, totally weak sauce.
Yeah. No, it definitely takes a lot of thought and planning to do it well, but I mean, that's kind of all design, right? You know, it's like, if you're going to do it well, you have to think things through and try things out, and that's how you'll get to the really great combination that works for what you need to say.
You mentioned CodePen. Mm-hmm. Where are some other sites that people who maybe aren't designers that are kind of wishing that they were, mm-hmm. or they want to be a developer designer, can start exploring other people's animations and the work that they're doing?
Yeah, CodePen's a really great one. It has a really, they probably have the best kind of like exploring feature that I've seen, at least visually mm-hmm. be able to explore stuff with little thumbnails. JSBin has a lot of great stuff too. And those are kind of the main two that I use as far as like just seeing other people's little experiments.
And these
stuff.
Are galleries where you basically have a CSS pane, a JavaScript mm-hmm. pane, and an HTML
yep,
pane.
Yep.
And you just sign up and you can start writing your code there and then immediately share it.
Yeah, yeah, it's really handy that way. I think I know I use it a lot for like workshops and stuff too, because then no one has to like have text editors installed mm-hmm. there. It doesn't even matter what they have installed. You're just like, go to CodePen, get an account. We're all dealing with the same stuff.
Right, no install and everything just works.
So it's pretty handy. It's fun to just like pop in there and try something out, and if it sucks, just delete it. Mm-hmm. No one has to know. And if you like it, share it.
Do you keep a library of animations or like of interactions, or are you always writing them completely from scratch? Like, do you have your own stash?
I kind of do it on a per project basis, because I feel like, you know, the you know, when we were talking about the easing and the personality of the animation, I feel like you want to keep a lot of that consistent across a project, because you pick easing that fits your message, like the whole yoga studio fast flashing button thing. So I like to do it on a per project thing. And there's a lot of ones like usually like fade and scale that I pretty much make for everything and just use them in different combinations. I don't usually... If I share them across projects, it's just like I start with them and then change it all kind of thing.
Just kind of copy paste as a jump start.
Yeah, I kind of feel like the, you know, if you're going to bother to animate anything at all, it should really fit with your design, and probably doesn't apply to the, or, you know, pulling from the last project you did probably isn't going to help that much, but that's just me.
When people do the big picture design, they have like, here's the visual language of our site. Here's the font that represents, you know, here's the buttons. And they get all the way down. How do you express though, like, here's our animation language, because you could hand a bunch of suits 8.5 or 11 sheets of paper, you can paste them up on the wall, but how do you say, here's the activeness of our site?
I generally do it in two ways. We'll start a lot of the time with like sort of like an element collage type thing, where it's like just showing static elements, and you might show like a mini storyboard of like, here's how this button might change, just to get people the idea like, here's where motion might make sense. And then once you start doing things, like a lot of projects I've been working on recently sort of have a style guide or like a pattern lab of sorts, where this living browser based thing shows stuff like your main colors, your main typefaces. Then you can just have, even if it's just like little squares of like showing, here's how motion should happen. This is like the easing curves we should use.
So like almost like a bootstrap one pager where it's like, here's all our buttons, and you can actually interact with it and see those animations and decide upon them.
Yeah, and even a step below that of just being like, you know, here's how things should move. Like, here's a square, and this is, you know, the easing we want to use, or this is maybe here's the four different easings we want to use, and here's how they work together, or which ones are best for which. And, you know, it's a little, it kind of fits in with all the same type stuff of like, here's our typeface, and here's the 10 sizes we're going to use. It's really similar.
Very cool. So where can people find you online and get to your research? And you also sell an ebook.
All of my stuff is generally at valhead.com. That's my site. You can find me on Twitter at VLH. I have a book on CSS animation that's published by Five Simple Steps. That's linked from my site as well, and also on Five Simple Steps, because, you know, they do that too, since they published it.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much, Valhead, for chatting with us today. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.